This is New England Public Radio's Jazz Beat. I'm Tom Reaney with a podcast edition of my jazz blog, which you can find at nepr.net. Today's podcast examines the legacy of bassist Scott LaFaro. One of the most substantial biographies I've read in recent years is the 2009 publication that Helene LaFaro Fernandez devoted to her brother Scott. The great bassist is best known for his work with the Bill Evans Trio between 1959 and 61, and for the tragic car accident that claimed his life on July 6, 1961, 2 weeks after the trio's legendary performance at the Village Vanguard. Rocco Scott LaFaro burned like a meteorite, rising to the top rank of bass players in a few short years and working with the who's who of jazz greats in the compressed time frame preceding his death at age 25. His innovative breakthrough, which combined virtuoso technique with a counter-melodic conception, was captured in all its glory at the Vanguard on June 25, 1961. The two albums released by Riverside Records from that fabled performance, Sunday at the Village Vanguard and Waltz for Debbie, have long stood as his epitaph. Jade Visions, The Life and Music of Scott LaFaro, recounts how 3 days after his appearance at the Newport Jazz Festival with the Stan Getz Quartet, he had driven to Geneva, New York to take care of some business related to his mother's home there. Scotty grew up in Geneva, where his father Joe, who had played with Paul Whiteman and the Dorsey Brothers, earned a living as a violinist and shared his fondness for both classical music and big band jazz with his children. Helene says that she and Scotty were taken to hear Tony Bennett, the Mills Brothers, Dizzy Gillespie, and numerous others. She recalls that Zoot Sims so impressed her brother that he was impatient for the intermission to end, and that bassist Leroy Vinegar hummed all the while he was playing, a habit Scotty later developed as well. Helene says he talked about seeing Duke Ellington for weeks, shaking his head in disbelief over how they could fool with the melody and make it so much more. As for religion, she says we went wherever the music was best. That was Dad's criterion, be it a mass at a Roman Catholic church or Friday evening Shabbat dinner at the Cantor's home. Scotty's first instruments were piano, clarinet, and tenor saxophone. It wasn't until he left for Ithaca College, where music majors were required to play a stringed instrument, that he first played bass. He proved to be a natural for the instrument, which obsessed him, and early in his sophomore year, he went on the road with Buddy Morrow's orchestra. Dick Johnson, the saxophonist from Brockton, Massachusetts, was also on the band. He told Helene that Scott lived for the bass. He was looking all the time to play. He would have played 24 hours a day if he could. He was learning a mile a minute. Morrow's outfit had a big hit with Night Train. The band leader told Helene, "We were a band which was dedicated at the time to mainly rhythm and blues. We were the kind that played a fraction, a millimeter, behind the beat. We had to have a strong rhythm section, and he was definitely of that caliber. He was a dedicated person, intolerant of anyone who wasn't giving his best." Here's LaFaro playing the blues known as For Real with Hampton Hawes, Harold Land, and Frank Butler. Thank you. LaFaro left Buddy Morrow and settled in Los Angeles in 1957. "I don't blame him," said Morrow. "He was a tremendous talent who wanted to go on to greener pastures." Over the next 2 years, Scotty toured the country with Chet Baker and worked around L.A. with Hampton Hawes, Buddy DeFranco, Richie Kamuka, Joe Gordon, and Stan Kenton. He played sessions at the Lighthouse in Hermosa Beach and roomed with fellow bass player Charlie Hayden, who recalled the first time LaFaro mentioned Bill Evans. "I remember one time Scotty came home with an LP under his arm. He was excited. He said, 'Man, you got to hear this. This is the best piano player I've ever heard.' It was Evans's debut album, New Jazz Conceptions." Scotty also befriended the pianist Victor Feldman and recorded with him and drummer Stan Levy in January 1958. Though it previously appeared with Buddy Morrow on record, the arrival of Victor Feldman was essentially the first LP that showcased his singular gifts. The critics Nat Hentoff and Ralph J. Gleason took note. Hentoff heard LaFaro as the most important new bassist since Paul Chambers and Wilbur Ware, and he added, "It may be necessary to add for those hearing LaFaro for the first time that his bass is not electronically amplified. That huge sound and strength of attack is finger-sprung alone." Ralph Gleason commented, "It is, however, as a vehicle for bassist Scott LaFaro that the album really impresses." Here's Scotty with Feldman playing Vibes on Serpent's Tooth. Later in 1958, LaFaro toured and recorded with the Cal Jader, Stan Getz Sextet. John Tynan, writing in Downbeat, said, "The rhythm duo of LaFaro and drummer Billy Higgins were the baddest cats on the date." He said, "LaFaro is a potent cup of tea. A brilliant future is in store for this youthful bassist from Geneva, New York." LaFaro signed on with Stan Kenton for a tour in the spring of 1959. Aileen notes that the gig was tremendously exciting for him, since to play with Kenton had been one of his dreams as a kid in Geneva. In the liner notes to the Stan Kenton Orchestra in concert, the saxophonist Lenny Niehaus lauded LaFaro's wild sound. But Kenton bandmate Stephen Harris understood that a big band was hardly the ideal setting for him. In Jade Visions, he says, "Scott wasn't what one would consider a big band bass player. We all knew something important was going to happen with this guy." Jade Visions is suffused with the perspective of Aileen, an admiring yet candid sister who overcame the grief of her beloved brother's sudden death and drew inspiration from friends and fans who urged her to write this richly evocative and musically illuminating volume. Aileen makes no secret of LaFaro's exacting standards and competitive personality, and she quotes many who testify to the same. Pianist Pat Moran, who led a trio that Scott toured and recorded with in 1958, says he was very aware of his genius and used to love to go into clubs and intimidate bass players. He was quite a character, lots of fun. Moran is little known today as Patty Moran McCoy, but in 1960, LaFaro told Martin Williams, "I don't even like any of my records, except maybe the first one I did with Pat Moran." Here's LaFaro with Moran playing with the time on a standard from My Fair Lady. Steve Kuhn, who felt a brotherly kinship with Scotty and says his sudden death was the first major loss of my life, describes him as very strong-willed. A case in point was LaFaro's departure from Stan Kenton, which was precipitated by his displeasure with the band's new drummer, a situation that would repeat itself in 1961 when he insisted that Stan Getz replace drummer Pete LaRocca. In the latter case, Getz fired LaRocca and hired Roy Haynes. But Kenton wasn't about to be second-guessed. He stuck with his new hire, offered Scotty the option of plane fare to New York or Los Angeles, and showed him the door. Upon returning to L.A., LaFaro phoned his friend Herb Geller, who was then playing alto with Benny Goodman in New York. Geller said Goodman was unhappy with his current bassist and offered to recommend Scotty, but he cautioned, "Benny's very conservative. Don't do any of those fast things you can do. Don't get fancy. No double beats. Play what's written." LaFaro flew east, passed the audition, and signed on for a six-week tour of one-nighters with Goodman. Geller recalls that at the end of Scotty's first night with the clarinetist, the two went around to hear Bill Evans. Paul Motion was on drums, Nobi Tota on bass. Scotty sat in. There was great rapport. Bill had first heard Scotty with Chet Baker 3 years earlier. Not long after we were back off the Goodman tour, there was a call waiting for Scotty that Bill Evans wanted him to work with him. The first meeting of what became known as the trio took place at the clarinet player Tony Scott's recording session in October 1959. The highlight of the session was Scott's original composition, Misery, which he dedicated to Billie Holiday. Bill Evans's biographer Peter Pettinger said of the recording, "Not much happens, but a wavelength is established between the pianist and bassist." For Evans, Misery offered a glimpse of a relationship to come. On December 28, 1959, the Bill Evans Trio made its premiere recording for Riverside Records. In his liner notes for Portrait in Jazz, producer Orrin Keepnews focused on the phenomenon of Bill Evans, the pianist. But the lone paragraph devoted to the other members of the trio noted that they weren't limited to conventional rhythmic backing, and he cited Autumn Leaves as a harbinger of things to come. He quoted Evans, who said, "I'm hoping the trio will grow in the direction of simultaneous improvisation. If the bass player, for example, hears an idea that he wants to answer, why should he just keep playing a background?" LaFaro, of course, heard and answered plenty of ideas. Ted Gioia, in his book The History of Jazz, said, "LaFaro took far greater chances, departing markedly from the traditional walking bass line, instead offering counter-melodies and guitar-like phrases. His sense of time was freer, less tied to the ground beat, than any jazz bassist had previously achieved. It is not going too far to see this short-lived trio as redefining the nature of the jazz rhythm section." Here's the Bill Evans Trio playing Autumn Leaves. Jade Visions credits the demo session that LaFaro made with Steve Kuhn and Pete LaRocca nearly a year later as one where this conversational approach to group dynamics was evident. In his essay, Scott LaFaro, The Complete Musician, Jeff Campbell singles out the trio's performance of So What, saying that LaFaro and Kuhn engage in a brief musical dialogue just prior to the return of the theme and improvise melodic ideas that are intertwined in a conversational manner. Campbell says, it is an interesting fact that the earliest example of LaFaro's active conversational ballad accompaniment was with Steve Kuhn and not Bill Evans. But when I ran this claim by Kuhn a few years ago, he said, I don't agree with that necessarily. Scott was already playing like that with Bill. Steve Kuhn recorded his four-song demo in November 1960, but it wasn't officially released until 2005. Like Evans, Kuhn, who'd arrived on the New York scene in 1959 as a 21-year-old Harvard grad, was being managed by Helen Keane. She proposed the demo as something to shop around to record labels. Alas, nothing came of it. Kuhn is uncertain about exactly where he met LaFaro, but says it was most likely when he heard the Evans Trio at the Five Spot late in 1959. He says they formed an immediate friendship, and that musically, I'd never felt such an instant connection. He had an incredible ear. He heard what I was doing at the piano, and I heard what he was doing. I adored him, and I was thrilled to be able to work with him. We were like brothers. 6 months before the session with Kuhn, LaFaro had recorded with trumpeter Booker Little in April 1960. Little, another ill-fated star of the period who died at 23 in October 1961, described LaFaro in the liner notes as distant but close, a paradox that resolves only for those who were simpatico. He also recognized LaFaro as an innovator who was much more of a conversationalist behind you than any other bassist I know. He's technically about the greatest bassist we have. Remarking on the solo LaFaro plays on BT's minor plea, the trumpeter said the bass is a crude and rude instrument, but Scott makes it into something else. Aileen says Scotty would have loved being described as something else, since I could remember how excited he was when he brought around to play for me the first record of Ornette Coleman, Something Else. Here's LaFaro with Booker Little. In May 1960, the Bill Evans Trio joined in a program at Circle in the Square in New York that was devoted to Gunther Schuller's compositions. Ornette Coleman, Eric Dolphy, and LaFaro were also featured, and Scotty drew notice from Dan Morgenstern in Metronome for a solo remarkable for its technical skill and musical weight. The piece was Schuller's elaboration on John Lewis's Elegy for Django Reinhardt, variants on a theme by John Lewis, which he would also appear on in December when Schuller's work was recorded for the Atlantic Records release, Jazz Abstractions. In Jade Visions, Schuller recalled, "Here I was into Schoenberg, Stravinsky, and all of that, and I needed people who could read and improvise. So when Scott came to town, it was like manna from heaven." Here is LaFaro with Schuller's ensemble playing the variation on Django. Thank you. LaFaro began working regularly with Ornette Coleman after Bill Evans became ill with hepatitis in July 1960. Evans's illness resulted in the cancellation of a long engagement opposite Thelonious Monk at the Jazz Gallery. Ornette's group with Don Cherry and Ed Blackwell played the Village Gate for 3 weeks in August and September, followed by engagements in California. At that year's Monterey Jazz Festival, LaFaro performed with both the Coleman Quartet and Gunther Schuller. Ornette drew mixed reviews everywhere, including Monterey, where his performance elicited a scathing review from John Tynan, who said it was patently bad, disturbed, and utterly unhappy. Still, he singled out LaFaro for his brilliant technique and ideas. In the midst of this recognition that LaFaro received as a young master, he was given to introspective thoughts about where the music was going and what he recognized as the increasing distance between jazz's new direction and the public. In a December 29, 1960 letter addressed to his girlfriend Gloria Gabriel, the dancer to whom he dedicated Gloria's Step, he wrote, "One important thing I realized day by day is that the true artist and musician is becoming more and more meaningless in terms of public comprehension. This brings about the situation of whether I should spend these hours and months developing what I seem to be able to foresee, or should I dump it and get another job as an entertainer. My day consists of such a singular preoccupation, the physicology of music. I'm in the position of having nothing you can put your finger on for sale." Bill Evans' drug addiction was also a matter of concern for LaFaro. Oren Keepnews told Aileen that when the trio recorded its second session, Explorations, in February 1961, Scott was being very explicit about his problem. He was very reluctant to go back on the road unless it was for a lot more money. As he put it, being out with a leader who was a junkie put him at risk of being stranded. The tensions ebbed and flowed that afternoon, but strangely enough, we were accomplishing what we had set out to do. The lesson to be learned here is probably something about the value of professionalism. While LaFaro was cautious about touring with Evans and eschewed drug use, he was intrigued by Bill's interest in Zen meditation, which he practiced and discussed with Aileen. He used a Zen epigram in the closing of his letter to Gloria, "If you seek the fruits of good action, so shall they escape you." He added, "I try to smile every day with that." When I asked Steve Kuhn if Scotty had similar anxieties about touring with Stan Getz, he said no, but he recalled a bandstand incident between LaFaro and the famous tenor player whom Kuhn called extraordinarily paranoid. He recalled a night at the Blackhawk in San Francisco when they clashed. Stan was playing a melody, and Scott began doubling it. Right there on stage, Stan stopped playing and yelled, "MF, I've got the melody." Notwithstanding flare-ups of this kind, Kuhn says that Getz held LaFaro in the highest regard. Scott was extremely picky and choosy, and he wanted to select the members of the rhythm section. Stan said fine. Kuhn and drummer Pete LaRocca were Scotty's choices, but in the midst of a 2-week engagement at the Sutherland Hotel in Chicago, LaFaro had got tired of LaRocca's playing. "He played a lot of top, of cymbals, and Scotty wanted more drums," says Kuhn. He insisted that Stan fire LaRocca and hire Roy Haynes, and Stan was so impressed with how strong and unique Scotty was that he acceded to his wishes. LaFaro continued to divide his time between Getz, Ornette, and Evans in 1961. He recorded with pianist Don Friedman as well. Friedman first heard LaFaro with Buddy Morrow, and then they worked together with Chet Baker. When Scotty came east to play with Benny Goodman, he shared a Coldwater flat in the East 70s with Friedman that went for $18 a month. They worked together with vocalist Dick Hames, whose roadshow included dancers and a comic. Gloria Gabriel was one of the dancers. In Jade Visions, Friedman says, "He used to play my piano and was very interested in minor seventh chords with the flat fifth. In fact, the tune Glorious Step was an outgrowth of his interest in those chords. He also recalls getting the call from Scotty to spell the ailing Bill Evans for a couple of nights at the Jazz Gallery. Friedman, LaRocca, and LaFaro recorded a demo session in 1961 that's now available on the CD Pieces of Jade. Bill Evans Trio's appearance at the Village Vanguard opposite Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross in June 1961 culminated with the legendary recordings that were made on the last day of the two-week engagement, Sunday, June 25th. Bassist Mark Johnson, who was with Bill Evans between 1978 and the pianist's death in 1980, wrote in the liner notes for Pieces of Jade that the Vanguard performance was the highest measure of Scott's musical vision. Johnson says, "I must have listened to those recordings thousands of times. To this day, I still don't see how Scott articulated his ideas with such startling clarity and velocity." Johnson also speaks for the continuing hold that the recordings have on listeners, touched not only by their innovation, but their emotional richness. "All that listening to the trio had another effect on me. My early years at the university were thoroughly engaging intellectually. Those years of self-discovery can be challenging at times, and those moments found their perfect expression in the Village Vanguard sessions. I listened to that music for so many hours that it became my constant silent companion and a beacon of hope." Joe LaBarbera played drums in the trio with Evans and Mark Johnson. He says Evans said that Scott hated it when the music remained the same, so they were constantly trying for fresh approaches and fresh improvisations. And Bill told me, "I remember it exactly. If I played the same lick on a tune two nights in a row, the next time I played it, Scott would play it with me in harmony. He would actually harmonize it so that at that point it was time for me to get rid of that lick and move on to something else." Following the Vanguard engagement, LaFaro played with Stan Getz, Steve Kuhn, and Roy Haynes at the Newport Jazz Festival on July 2nd. Three tunes from their set, Arigen, Where Do You Go, and Baubles, Bangles, and Beads, were released on CD in 1994. Haynes shared with Scotty a fastidiousness about clothing and had just been named to Esquire's Best Dress list. He remembered that Scotty was dressed up for the Newport appearance. In 2007, 46 years later, Roy Haynes introduced Aileen to the great young bassist Christian McBride. She writes, "What he said not only had an impact on me, but seemed to sum up much of what I had been hearing as I talked to musicians." McBride said, "Scotty's playing was the Bible for bass players. Jimmy Blanton the Old Testament, Scotty the New." LaFaro spent the evening of July 5, 1961 with old friends in upstate New York. Chuck Mangione and his brother Gap were among the locals hanging out that night, and Jade Visions includes Gap's recollection of listening with Scotty to Chet Baker's recording of Grey December. Mangione remembers LaFaro calling Baker an American tragedy and says, "Over the years, Scott's using the term an American tragedy still strikes me as incredibly ironic and portentous given what happened that night." At about 1:45 on the morning of July 6th, LaFaro apparently fell asleep at the wheel and veered off New York Route 20, hitting a tree and killing himself and his friend Frank Otley instantly. The Stan Getz Quartet, with either Henry Grimes or Jimmy Garrison spelling LaFaro, was playing that week at Saranac Lake in the Adirondacks. Steve Kuhn remembers hearing that it was a St. Christopher medal that LaFaro always wore that helped to identify his badly burned body. He says that word of the accident reached Getz over the wire through his manager Jack Wiedemore, and that they were all incredulous and heartsick at the news. The group attended the funeral in Geneva, which Kuhn poignantly recalls was closed casket. Scott LaFaro's death was devastating to Bill Evans. In Meet Me at Jim and Andy's, Jazz Musicians and Their World, Gene Lees wrote, "The shock of LaFaro's death stayed with Bill for years, and he felt vaguely guilty about it. He felt that because of his heroin habit, he had made insufficient use of their time together. After LaFaro's death, Bill was like a man with a lost love, always looking to find its replacement." In 1966, Evans spoke frankly and forthrightly with George Clavin about what he called his complex and quick relationship with LaFaro. During the 13-minute-long interview, he said Scotty's technique was built through intuitive insight and fire, as some kind of a spark in him which took over, and he would just grab the bass, and he would work and work and work and work, and he would just lay it down. Scott LaFaro was honored in 2012 in Geneva, New York, where a street was renamed Scott LaFaro Drive, and an annual Scott LaFaro Day is now held. It's observed every year on his birthday anniversary, April 3rd. To see rare footage of Scott LaFaro on the Stars of Jazz television show and to hear the Bill Evans interview about Scotty, visit the Jazz a la Mode blog at nepr.net. Thanks to Katie Wright for production assistance. For Jazz Beat, I'm Tom Reaney.